Please be seated. Okay, so you have a little bit of a different time breakout than we usually have here, so I want to go over it just to be sure I know that I'm on the same page that you all are on, okay? So we're going to begin with Attorney Abraham, who is pro hoc vice, and I will ask you, have you already been admitted by the state, or are we going to have a motion for that now? You want to go to the microphone, counsel, if you're going to make a motion for me, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Ralph Weber, here for Koss and Michael Koss, and I'm here to move the admission pro hoc vice of Ahmed Ibrahim of California, who will argue for the appellant.
Okay, so he is licensed to practice law in California currently?
Yes, he is.
Okay, very good. Well, your motion certainly will be granted, and with that in mind, then, counsel, you will have 25 minutes as we begin, and then Attorney Lang, you will have 25 minutes following, and then Attorney Olson will have 5 minutes, so you're really breaking up that part of the presentation, and then back to you for rebuttal for five. Okay. All right, well, sounds interesting. Are you all prepared to begin? Please.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rogensack, fellow justices of the court. May it please the court, my name is Ahmed Ibrahim. I'm here to argue on behalf of Appellant Koss Corporation and Michael Koss. Just by way of background.
Counsel, this is Shirley Abrahamson. I cannot hear you unless you speak directly into the microphone and with some volume. And I would like to hear you and give you the opportunity to persuade me of the righteousness of your case.
Certainly, Your Honor. I will try to do a better job. I just lowered the microphone. And if you have trouble hearing me again, I'm sure Your Honor will not hesitate to let me know. Thank you.
I will not hesitate.
Your Honor, by way of background, this case comes to this court following the grant of summary judgment at the circuit court level in favor of the defendant respondent, Park Bank. We appealed the decision to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals affirmed summary judgment. We sought review, and now here we are. Your Honor, the Koss submits that the Court of Appeal erred in two principal respects. First, the Court of Appeals promulgated the wrong legal standard for what is required to demonstrate a financial institution's liability under the Wisconsin Uniform Fiduciaries Act, which I will refer to as the UFA. Koss requests that this court institute the correct consensus legal standard routinely applied by courts across the country in jurisdictions that have adopted the UFA. Second, because the Court of Appeals, as well as the Circuit Court, applied the wrong legal standard, both courts reached an incorrect result, namely granting summary judgment. In doing so, the courts below engaged in a factual analysis in which they improperly weighed evidence and resolved questions of fact. In Koss's view, this is plainly inconsistent with decades of Wisconsin jurisprudence on summary judgment.
Counsel, I hear what you're saying. It makes sense to me. That's why you're here. What you need to point out for me is where is the intent and how do you get there? There might be negligence. Where's the intent? I mean, you defended this case, or this case was defended on the notion, and others were defended, and I think the law of this case and the law of this act is that this is an intentional matter. So you're not alleging actual knowledge, right?
Correct. We are
so
not.
So you're under the bad faith part, which gets a little bit mushy. And that's why it's here, for us to define that. So when you put that element of intent there, and then you have the overlay of the facts of this case, where are the facts that support intent? In the cases, and I've read a lot of them, I've reread, and a lot of the cases, there's enough to get to a jury because you have something like red flags that continually come up in the bank, and they just ignore them because it's a big client or who knows why. They have different things that happen, like someone cashes a check or takes money out of one account and then pays a personal loan with the exact same bank. Certainly should at least raise some red flags. There is something that ties the conduct in such a way where you know it's not just that you drop the ball or Monday morning you know how, the outcome of the game, and you then can say, gosh, knowing this, when we look at that, it sure does, you know, look bad. It's got to be more than that. So where's the intent and how do you get there? And there's been a lot of discovery. I know courts are hesitant to grant summary judgment to a certain degree, but there are times you do grant it, and that's when someone doesn't prove an element. How do you want us to define bad faith, and where are the facts that support that here?
I think that's an excellent question, Your Honor, and Your Honor has gotten to the heart of the matter that is before the justices here today. First of all, in order to answer that question, I think we need to first define what is intent and what does intentional conduct mean in the context of bad faith under the UFA. And the standard that COSS believes is the appropriate standard that should be applied is the standard that is set forth in the Master Chemical Corporation versus Inkrot case, the Apley case, and several other cases that we've cited in our brief. And that standard provides that a bank acts in bad faith if the facts and circumstances surrounding the fiduciary's breach are so cogent and obvious that to remain passive would amount to a deliberate desire to evade knowledge because of a belief or fear that inquiry would disclose a defect in the transaction.
Cogent and obvious when? After it's all done and you look back on it and you say, gee, I wish we would have run it on the fourth down, or when is cogent and obvious?
Well, in order to determine cogent and obvious, you have to look at the facts that were available to the bank at the time.
And at which time? At the time which that they did petty cash, or the time they did a cashier's check, or which time?
Well, under the standard, Your Honor, I think it's both. It's actually the same thing, because the standard that's set forth in these cases provides for an objective standard. And so we don't have to, it's our position that COSS does not have to prove actual knowledge and actual suspicion.
I know, but you have to come kind of close. I mean, remember, this whole law came into place when it used to be that you could hold a bank responsible for being negligent. Then they decided to go a different way. And the way business is conducted on a regular basis, people need their banks to be responsive. In fact, they expect their banks to be responsive to wire transfers, to different things going on, to cashing checks, to making sure things get done. Now, if a bank is basically a separate insurance policy for a company not minding their own business well, we've got trouble. That's not what this act is about. So there has to be something that a bank really does that fits that intentional aspect of turning a blind eye, ignoring the obvious. And it can't just be, gosh, if we would have gotten notice a little bit earlier, we would have done things differently. It can't be that. So where is that nugget here in this record that shows that kind of, hey, they took this check and they deposited it to pay their own personal loan? I mean, it's not uncommon to have an American Express charge card paid through a corporate account or whatnot. I mean, business could come to a screeching halt if a bank needed board approval of every check or every petty cash account. It just wouldn't work. And the practical reality would be, frankly, consumers will hold the dollar here. The consumer, will, the banks are going to charge for this. They're going to have auditors and all sorts of investors if they have to always cover these kinds of litigation expenses because negligence essentially is enough to get to a jury. So you got to tell me, where is that extra thing that I see in all these other cases that I'm not seeing here?
Your Honor, your struggles are understandable, and they're understandable because we have a set of facts here that we've presented to the court and have made an argument that these facts constitute bad faith because Park Bank was aware of these facts and turned a blind eye to whether there was actual suspicious activity occurring.
That
and the struggle.
Every embezzlement case, though, every time someone embezzles, you could go back and say, hey, if we would have known then, we would have done things differently. It's got to be more than that. These other cases are more than that. Where's that here?
But Your Honor, the point is that you're struggling because these are factual questions, and factual questions should be decided by a jury, not by the court.
So a bank never can get out on summary judgment?
No, not at all, Your Honor. The facts that we've presented here in this case are quite compelling in our view.
That's what I'm asking you. Give me the nugget.
Well, the first nugget, Your Honor, is that there were signature cards that were routinely ignored by Park Bank. What occurred
that might
here,
be negligent, but what makes that intentionally turning a blind eye?
Well, it might be negligent to do it once. It might be negligent to do it five times. It might be negligent to do it 10 times. But to do it 200 times, 250 times, to ignore the signature card,
I think... So the thing that makes this different is it was a lot.
Yes, Your Honor, it was a lot.
So it
occurred over
once, twice a year, it wouldn't be bad faith.
Well, I'm not going to opine on whether once or twice might not be bad faith, but that's not the facts that we have presently before the court. We have an embezzlement that occurred over a 10-year period.
Okay, so when in the 10-year period is it the time when you know they were turning a blind eye?
Well, in this case,
because otherwise you're Monday morning again.
And Your Honor, we took into account the concerns that you had, and that is why Koss is not asserting that the bad faith occurred with the first transaction. Ms. Sachdeva started embezzling in the late 90s and the early 2000s. We are not asserting that the bad faith began to occur in the late 90s and the early 2000s. There were dozens and dozens of transactions that occurred between that time period and January 2005, which is when we are asserting that the bad faith was triggered. And the bad faith was triggered when an employee of Koss, who was not a signatory on the account, walked into the bank, signed a counter check, which is like a withdrawal slip, not a signatory, signed that withdrawal slip, gave it to the teller, and they gave her $60,000 in cashier's checks.
Counsel, now, where are the 200 times? I understand the $60,000 transaction. That's clearly set out, and I don't think it's denied by the bank that that occurred. But where are the 200 times that a signature card was ignored by the bank? I didn't get that many from your brief.
There, Your Honor, if we look in the record, and if Your Honor would grant the court's indulgence, I can look that up. But the 300 times comes from the quantity of cashier's checks that were issued by Park Bank in response to requests by Koss Corporation. And there's evidence in the record demonstrating that three-quarters of the requests, approximately three-quarters of the requests, did not come from Ms. Sachdeva, but came from a non-signatory, Julie Mulvaney, who was an assistant to Ms. Sachdeva, or through Ms. Caver. But the bulk of the requests for the cashier's checks came from Julie Mulvaney.
But they came under the authority of someone who was a signatory.
Your Honor, we would first of all.
Well, if they hadn't, that's fine. I understand your answer.
Again, counsel, I'd like to actually pick up on that point in particular. The UFA 112.09.01 sub 9 starts out: if a check is drawn upon the account of a fiduciary's principal in a bank by a fiduciary, and then it goes on. Who's responsible for determining whether a person standing in front of the counter is a fiduciary?
The fiduciary is defined as the person who's on the signature card, Your Honor.
Okay. So is it your position that the bank has a responsibility to check whether that person making the request is on the signature card?
Yes, Your Honor. We do take that position.
And then is it your position that the bad faith is not necessarily what Ms. Zagdeva did with the proceeds, but the bad faith was the bank's decision not to check the signature cards to determine whether the person withdrawing the cash had the authority to do that?
Yes, we believe that that is one form of the bad faith. And as we've asserted in our briefing, it's really the totality of the circumstances, Your Honor.
Okay. So, and if the person who appears in front of the counter to make the request for the withdrawal is not on the signatory card and therefore is not a fiduciary, does the UFA apply?
The UFA may apply. That issue is not presently before the court, Your Honor, but the UFA may apply because of the assertion here by Park Bank that the checks were drawn at the request of a fiduciary, namely Ms. Zagdeva. Because they've inserted that argument into this proceeding, then in essence they've conceded that the UFA would apply.
Well, if the UFA does not, the UFA is there to protect the bank from liability, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. If the UFA does not apply, that gives Cost Corporation broader latitude in pursuing the bank, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. So isn't the first step to addressing this case to determine whether the UFA applies?
I think that is an important consideration, yes, Your Honor. That presently isn't before the court in this proceeding, but yes, the UFA would have to apply
so
in order for the bank
is,
to invoke protections under the UFA.
Yeah. So why is that issue not in front of the court? The way I looked at the facts presented in this case, as you say, three quarters, I believe it was, of the cashier's checks were done at the behest of a non-signatory.
Yes, Your Honor.
If the non-signatory is not a fiduciary, the bank has no protection under the UFA for those transactions, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is that? Why is that question not before the court?
I think it's really more of a procedural issue, Your Honor. First of all, it was not raised in this summary judgment motion. There is another summary judgment motion, if memory serves me correctly, that is pending before the circuit court on that particular issue. And secondly, the second procedural issue is that there is no negligence claim in this case. The only claim that's being asserted by Cost Corporation is the claim under the UFA.
All right. So has Cost Corporation conceded that the UFA applies in this case and that the people and that the three quarters of the cashier's checks that were written at the behest of a non-signatory were actually done by a fiduciary? Has Cost conceded that?
We concede that the UFA applies. We don't necessarily concede the point that because Ms. Zagdeva is the one who directed that the checks be that the checks be issued, that means that the UFA should not apply or should apply.
But you can't have it both ways. You can't say you've engaged in bad faith because you had a non-fiduciary do this, and yet say, by the way, we're going to just say this is a fiduciary so we can make the claim. I mean, I understand why you don't want a negligence claim. I think everyone understands why you don't want this to be a negligence lawsuit. You're probably going to get a big goose egg on that, right? With respect to an intentional tort, though, you have to pick the horse, right? Are you going to use the fact that these are non-fiduciaries as part of your – because I hear you arguing that today, which is why I got to the point of give me the nugget. What is the thing that ties this all together that makes this the intentional tort for bad faith? Your answer to Chief Justice Rogenstack, to Justice Kelly, and to me was kind of these 200 times somebody who wasn't a fiduciary came in to do this. I mean, you might have been in my conversation with my law clerk at one point over this issue, but it wasn't raised. We're here to decide the definition of bad faith.
Well, we are, in my view, this case is a statutory interpretation case, so I may look at it a little differently than my colleagues. And when I look at the definition of fiduciary under 112.01 sub 1, it's quite broad. And we can argue about whether what happened here was by a fiduciary, whether it was the officer of the corporation, or whether it was an associate that the officer instructed to do this, that, or the other thing, right? Because an agent under the statute of the corporation is also a fiduciary. At least that's what the statute says, and no one's argued that what happened here was not done by a fiduciary. My major interest is in 1C, because in order to have the bank be responsible, they either have to have actual knowledge of the fraud, and that's not what we're looking at here, or they have to have actions of the bank that were not, in fact, honestly done. That's what the statute said. So I'm interested in what acts of the bank, with all these transactions which I'm sure, well, we wish had not occurred, but what acts of the bank were not honestly done? Because that's what the statute requires. I know what the case law says. This is a uniform laws case, and I was on the Uniform Laws Committee for a number of years, but this is Wisconsin's look at it. And I'm a person that, if the statute controls, I like to know what do the words in the statute mean. I think that's my job, because that's what's going to be used with this case going forward. So if you can tell me what in your submissions show that transactions were, quote, in fact, not honestly done, then that would really help me to understand the statute.
Understood, Your Honor. Thank you for the question. Your Honor, subdivision 9 of 112.01 is at issue here. And subdivision 9 does not include the language that Your Honor quoted, honestly or dishonestly.
But the definition says, it says, definitions in this section apply unless the context or subject matter otherwise requires. So I'm reading to you out of the definition section. I'm just trying to understand the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. And the case law has addressed that issue of whether the plaintiff in an action under the UFA has to prove dishonesty, has to prove an evil motive, has to prove corruption, has to prove moral guilt.
I'm just looking at honesty. I'm not looking at corruption. I'm looking at just what the words in the statute say. If you could just tell me what it is, that would help me a lot.
Sure, Your Honor. And the Koss's position is that there was a problem with the signature cards. The signature cards were not being checked. That's very important. I think most people would find it shocking if you can walk into a bank and you can pull out money from a bank without verifying your identity. And because that occurred routinely over several years and over well in excess of 100 transactions, and Park Bank turned a blind eye to that, we believe that constitutes bad faith, and under the statute that would be a form of dishonesty, because the way the case law has interpreted the statute and the UFA is that if the plaintiff is able to prove that there were facts that were so obvious and so cogent to demonstrate that there was wrongdoing, even if the bank is not conceding they actually knew it or actually suspected it, that the law deems that to be intentional conduct and deems that to be bad faith. So that's one piece of it, the signature cards.
Okay.
The second piece of it, Your Honor, is the fact that these transactions occurred with enormous dollar amounts. And in some cases, towards the end of the embezzlement, there were hundreds of thousands of dollars being requested every day. The fact that on the face of these cashier's checks, there were cryptic initials, SFA Inc. for Saks Fifth Avenue Inc., NM Inc., Neiman Marcus Inc. The mere fact that a corporation, instead of writing personal checks or other forms of payment, would choose to pay their bills through the format of cashier's checks, that didn't raise a red flag, apparently, to Park Bank, and they put blinders on.
Right. But on that in particular, isn't that the whole point of the UFA, so the bank doesn't have to inquire into that sort of thing?
Your Honor, to clarify our argument, Koss has never taken the position that Park Bank has to look at every single transaction. We've never taken that position.
All right.
And we look
at whether there's a violation of the UFA on a case-by-case, transaction-by-transaction analysis. We don't accumulate them, right?
Your Honor, no, I would respectfully disagree with that. I think that the case law indicates that you have to take a facts and circumstances approach. And you don't necessarily take it transaction by transaction, because then you run into the problem that Your Honor identified, which is that the UFA provided that banks should not be inquiring into every individual transaction.
Right,
and that's one of the reasons why we did not bring those early transactions in the late 90s into the case.
Yeah.
But at some point, Your Honor.
Let me stop you for just a second. So there were a number of tellers or other bank employees who were involved in these transactions. I don't remember the number. What was it? How many bank employees?
Park Bank asserts, I believe, there were approximately 45 to 50 bank employees.
So when we look at this, we don't impute the knowledge of each of those employees to the other, correct?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. I think that that's a factual issue. Now, that's certainly an issue that Park Bank could argue to a jury. They could argue to the jury that, look, there's 45 to 50 employees here. Not everyone is knowledgeable about everything, but I think there's a tribal issue on that.
And is the tribal issue the fact that the employees knew the others were doing this, or that is evidence of a bank practice and policy?
The latter, Your Honor. I think our argument would be that this is a bank practice. There was a bank practice and procedure and culture, quite frankly, of ignoring obvious red flags and allowing this embezzlement to continue.
Right. So it's not really the fact that there were hundreds of these transactions that are the red flag. The hundreds of transactions are evidence of the fact that the bank had a practice and a policy of ignoring red flags.
I think it would be both, Your Honor. I think we would be arguing that it's a totality of the circumstances. So it's not only ignoring the signature card, it's the amount of the transactions, the frequency of the transactions, the dollar amount involved, the concession by the bank manager to my client that we always thought, we always thought that this was strange, that they were requesting so many cashier's checks. That's a fact that would be presented to the jury. The fact that wire transfer policies at the bank, that those were being routinely ignored to accommodate the embezzlement. It's all of these facts together, Your Honor. And Koss has made it very clear. If there were only one set of facts or a small group of transactions, if this involved five transactions, if this involved a signature card being ignored 10 times, this would probably be more of a negligence case. But that's not what we have here, Your Honor. We have a group of facts, and I believe my
Your
time
light
is up.
Your light is on. Yes, it is.
And we have a group of facts establishing a pattern of activity over a nearly 10-year period. And for those reasons and the reasons set forth in our brief, we'd ask the Court to reverse summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Dean Lang, and I represent Park Bank, the respondent in this case. To date, four judges, one in the trial court and three in the Court of Appeals, have all unanimously found that Koss Corporation has failed to put forth enough facts of bad faith under the Uniform Fiduciaries Act to survive summary judgment. Now, Chief Justice Rogensack asked the question about honesty, which is found in the statutes. This case was pending in the trial court for almost 6 years. There were over 11,000 transactions in Koss's accounts during the relevant time frame. We're talking about 1 or 2% of those transactions.
So let's look at a subset of those 1 to 2%, and those would be the ones in which someone came to the bank and made a request for a cashier's check, and the person's name did not appear on the signatory card. What was the bank's practice and policy when it received a request for a withdrawal from someone who did not appear on a signatory card?
Actually, what happened is this. Either Sue Sachdeva would telephone the bank and request a cashier's check. She'd say the date, the payee, the amount, and the account to take the funds from.
And how did the bank know it was Ms. Sachdeva making the request?
She would call the tellers, and it's not in the record, but I assume someone who she would identify herself as Sue Sachdeva.
So anybody calling up and identifying herself as Sue Sachdeva would be able to direct Park Bank to make a disbursement from one of Costa's accounts?
Well, she's a signatory on the account. I mean, if you and I are required every time we want to do a transaction to go into the bank, it would be impractical.
Well, did she just call and say any account, or did she give account numbers?
The account number, the name of the account, Park Bank's account, she gave all the information. Or alternatively, her assistant, her right-hand person, Julie Mulvaney, would call the bank. They recognized her voice. She said, I'm calling on behalf of Sue. I'm given the date, the time, the amount, the account. Then what happened?
Counsel, the bank disperses funds from a corporation's account based on a clerk's voice recognition over a phone?
Well, that's what happens every day when we go into the bank. I mean, we don't necessarily present ID, even if we go there personally. They recognize you. They do the transaction. But then what happened is somebody, generally Betty Caver, would go to the bank and there'd be an envelope addressed to either Koss or to Sue Sachdeva. That would go back to Sue Sachdeva. There's no dispute in this case that every penny of the $13 million that were embezzled from Park Bank, use of Park Bank's funds or the funds of Park Bank, were all gotten into the hands of Sue Sachdeva and she used them personally.
That's not really the question here, though. Right? The question is what the bank's practice was and whether the bank acted in bad faith in making the disbursements. I'll just set this up for you from my perspective. This whole embezzlement scheme came crashing down when American Express said, this looks funny, and called Koss.
Correct? Correct.
So I think a jury could reasonably conclude that if someone from Park Bank had called Koss and said, this looks funny, maybe it would have stopped then. So I'm not, for my part at least, and obviously I don't speak for the court, but I'm not impressed with the fact that this was all actually spent by Ms. Sachdeva. What I'm interested in is what the bank's responsibility was in making these disbursements, all right? On this point, what I'm interested in is, why do you have a signatory card if it's not checked?
Well, those four people identified are the people responsible and entitled to withdraw funds from the account. Your questions, though, go to the heart of negligence,
not to
the heart of the UFA.
No, hang on. So tell me that again. Each of these four people was authorized on the signature card to make withdrawals?
Correct.
Their names were on the signature card?
Correct.
Whose names?
Sue Sachdeva, Michael Koss, John Koss Jr., and then a descriptive name for the MIS supervisor.
I'm sorry. I was unclear in my request. So I'm referring to the transactions in which a non-signatory was allowed to withdraw money from a Koss account. And my understanding is that approximately three-quarters of the cashier's checks were done by someone whose name was not on the signatory card.
So Julie Mulvaney made the phone calls on behalf of Sue Sachdeva, yes.
Okay. So, and Julie's name is not on the card.
Correct.
All right. So, all Julie, from the bank's perspective, the only thing necessary to withdraw Koss's money from Park Bank is for somebody to call up and say, I'm doing this on behalf of somebody who's on the signature card. And that's good enough for the bank?
Well, the bank recognizes and knows who Sue Sachdeva is. The bank recognizes and knows who Julie Mulvaney is, and it would be no different than me calling my bank and saying, I want to withdraw some funds.
And your bank will just give out money in your name just by a phone call?
I've not tried it, but I'm assuming if I called my bank and said my wife or my child or whoever is going to come in, put it in an envelope and give it to that person, they would. The other thing you got to keep in mind is each and every month for this entire time frame, costs received monthly statements. Those statements.
Before you go there, counsel, can I just back you up? Is there anything in the record documenting what bank practice is in that regard? Because what you're describing
is not consistent with my personal experience, but my personal experience isn't in the record. So could you identify for us at some point, I'm not asking you to do it right now, but I would like to know, is there something in the record documenting what bank practices or testimony by experts about how people should or are able to withdraw large sums of money from bank accounts?
I don't believe there is.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel,
yes.
So the practice and policy, I'm hearing some of my colleagues talk about practice and policy. I've typically heard that phrase in terms of what is the standard in the industry. Often that comes up in a negligence case. So how do we know the difference between the standard in the industry vis-a-vis a negligence case and the standard in the industry vis-a-vis an intentional tort of bad faith?
You know, that goes to the heart of this entire case, Your Honor. Give you a little background. Initially, Cost sued for negligence and violation of the UFA. They then ultimately, when were ordered to produce discovery on the contributory negligence of Michael Cost and Cost, they chose strategically to withdraw the negligence case. That goes to Justice Kelly's question. And they have decided strategically to try to avoid discovery by saying we're only going to fall under the UFA. We're only going to seek those claims that relate to a fiduciary. So whoever said it earlier that they want to have it both ways, want to have their cake and eat it too, was absolutely correct. Having said that, this case from the very beginning, if you look at the complaint, the first complaint, which was asserting only a negligence case, and you match that up with the last complaint, which asserts only a UFA claim, you will see that all of the facts are the same.
Well, that's why I'm asking my question, because I did that very thing, and I was trying to figure out what changed.
Nothing's changed. If you look at their expert, Pat McElroy, testified at page 159 of his deposition. When I pressed him over and over and over again to tell me, what do you mean by bad faith? Because you keep using those buzzwords. He said it consists of, quote, anything that was commercially unjustifiable for Park Bank employees, end quote. If you look at his report, he says that Park Bank engaged in bad faith by, quote, violating reasonable banking industry standards, end quote. That's the standard of care and negligence. Did somebody fall below the standard of care? And that's what this case has been about from day one. Cost wants to say Park Bank put their head in the sand. They were blind. They were lazy. They were dumb. They didn't see something that was hitting them in the face. But this case is not about that. This case is about honesty, deceitfulness, dishonesty. That's what this case is about.
Let me just stop, I guess, where questions started earlier on the definition of honesty. I mean, as I've read the cases that interpret the word honesty, they uniformly indicate that we're not talking about any morality here. It's not a moral failing we're talking about, nor is it, another case I would cite is, you know, evil intent, nor, as the Caputo case says, sinister motive. So although the word honesty in the vernacular may connote some kind of moral aspect, none of the cases that I have read defining that uphold that. In fact, they eschew that. I like saying eschew, so I try to get it in every once in a while. So, I mean, tell me, am I correct or am I not reading enough cases?
Well, I would tell you this. However bad faith is defined in any context, it always requires dishonesty. It always does. If you look at the Wisconsin jury instruction and law on bad faith in the insurance context, what you'll see is the jury instruction tells the jury, bad faith carries with it a suggestion of dishonest or deceitful conduct.
Let's look at that jury instruction, because I reviewed it in preparation, and I find it quite interesting, because it goes on to state that it involves a reckless disregard. That's what bad faith by insurance company, jury instruction 2761 says. And this, I think, is in part what your opposing counsel is talking about. He talks about turning a blind eye. The New Jersey Supreme Court in Caputo uses a little different phrase. It talks about reckless disregard, but it indicates that in the face of compelling and obvious facts, it is bad faith to remain passive, turn a blind eye, remain passive, and not inquire further, because such inaction amounts to a deliberate desire to evade knowledge. So in reading the Caputo case, I smile when I hear your arguments and I see the standard set by the Court of Appeals. The standard set by the Court of Appeals includes the second element, a deliberate failure to investigate. But the Caputo case says a deliberate failure to investigate includes, like the insurance bad faith instruction, reckless disregard. It is remaining passive. So we can take the Court of Appeals standard as written, a deliberate failure, or we can interpret a deliberate failure, as Caputo did, to include the reckless disregard, the remaining passive, turning a blind eye, as your opposing counsel notes. Why shouldn't we adopt the Caputo analysis?
Well, first of all, it's a minority. Second of all, I was really referring to jury instruction 2760. And the comments say to that, the concept of bad faith under Wisconsin law is, and always has been, a species of fraud and carries with it the suggestion of the company's not having dealt fairly and honestly with its insured.
What's the title, if I might? Because what
I was reading, 2760 is bad faith by insurance company.
Yes, 2761 is more specific. Bad faith by insurance company, assured's claim. Yeah. And that says if you find the insurance company either refused to consider the claim for damages, and then goes on to talk from these facts, a reckless disregard on the insurance company's part to learn that there was no reasonable basis to deny.
I would tell you this. In reviewing the cases, and I have them all in the binder right here, I came up with 10 guideposts that the courts have all said with respect to applying bad faith in a UFA context. They said this. Banks are entitled to presume that withdrawals from their customers' accounts are done for proper purposes. Bad faith requires much more than negligent conduct. Bad faith is not simply bad judgment. Hindsight is not relevant. Bad faith requires a purposeful act of wrongdoing. It requires deliberate, willful conduct. Bad faith is in the nature of fraud, like our jury instruction says. It requires dishonest and deceitful conduct. In fact, the UFA statute says that. If you're going to say that this is really kind of a negligence case, let's call it recklessness, you're going to do away with the whole purpose of the UFA.
So, counsel, do you disagree with the Court of Appeals formulation of the bad faith standard?
I do, in one sense. I disagree with the first element, okay? And the first element phrased by the Court of Appeals says this: circumstances that are suspicious enough to place a bank on notice of improper conduct. Now, if you read that, it almost suggests for the first element an objective standard. There is no case in the country on UFA that I'm aware of that says it's an objective standard. In fact, there's a number of them that say it's a subjective standard. Okay? You jump in the mind of the bank. Okay? No different than the first case you had before you today. A police officer has to react. A bank teller, 49 bank tellers in this case, an average of 7 transactions over 10 years. And they're supposed to go huddle with each other while people are standing in their lines. They're supposed to talk about this or that. This is the spur-of-the-moment stuff. This is not where everybody gets together in a meeting and says to somebody, hey, what do you think about that cost account? You know, cost has never called us once, even though we've given them copies of debit memos which said on it, cashier's checks per sue, Sachdeva. Not a phone call, ever. Led Park Bank to believe everything was fine. Everything was company approved. Everything was appropriately spent on company.
Counsel, I'm curious as to why you say Caputo is in the minority. I mean, regardless of the discussion that we're having, I mean, I'm interested in what this test is. I think that's part of our obligation, and then we apply the facts here to the test. And when you look at the test created by the Court of Appeals, there is no case that I saw that creates such a test. And, in fact, the only cases that really give any kind of hint of that requirement are a couple of cases out of the Court of Appeals in Illinois. But we've got Ohio Supreme Court and the Fourth Circuit and on and on, the Caputo case. All of these cases seem to employ the same language, which seems to be the test from a uniform aspect throughout the country of these facts, of whether the facts are suggesting this kind of misconduct, that those facts are compelling and obvious, such that it is bad faith to remain passive and not inquire further. So why shouldn't we apply that test to the facts of this case? And then I guess my second question is, if we do apply the facts to that, this test to the facts of this case, are you still then arguing that there's still no bad faith?
Well, there is nothing in the record to demonstrate any dishonest, any intentional conduct. Nothing.
Well, and applying this specific test, though, first, I mean, this test is used by many courts across the country, correct?
Well, here, let's look at the latest Court of Appeals case in the federal court, and it's the Buffett's case, and it's from the Eighth Circuit, 2013.
Okay? Do you cite that case?
I do, yes. Yes, we did, and yes, I do
okay,
have a cite.
Okay, what's the cite?
It's 732 F3rd 889. Okay. That court says this, cited authorities from other jurisdictions that use a commercially unjustifiable standard, which is what they want to do, unreasonable, it wasn't prudent, they put their head in the sand, do not stand for the proposition that all commercially unjustifiable actions expose banks to liability for a customer's breach, etc. Rather, the inquiry is whether the bank exhibited the deliberate desire to evade knowledge because of a fear or belief that they're going to figure out the embezzlement. So there's two pieces to that. You have to intentionally say, I'm going to ignore it. Okay. Here, we produce hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. There's not one email, one document in this case to say, a teller said to somebody else, hey, listen, I think something's amiss. And the teller said, hey, just don't worry about it. There's none of that. There's no allegations of friendship. There's no allegations of vacationing. There's no allegation that these people knew each other or that they were good referrers or anybody else. So all of the cases, they might not did it as succinctly as the Court of Appeals and said one and two, but virtually all of the cases will pick up on those elements, and most of them pick up on two. But it's the deliberate, intentional, conscious desire to evade the knowledge.
Or that inaction amounts to the deliberate desire. I don't know that you have to say that you deliberately didn't investigate. Couldn't inaction amount to that if the facts were so compelling that you should have looked into it?
Well, so then you're going to wipe away the UFA. Understand
that's
the effect.
Caputo. Does Caputo wipe away the UFA in your mind?
But understand, if you do that, you are putting the bank in a worse position that they were in pre-UFA. Because if you call it an intentional tort and there's no contribution, then this bank is left in a position that it's worse than common law negligence. It's worse than pre-UFA.
Well, that depends on what the nature of the allegation is, doesn't it? In your brief, you cited O'Malley versus First Midwest Bank, and you seem to do so approvingly. Is that right?
Whatever I cited from that case, I approved of that citation, yes.
All right. So here's
I don't know if I agreed with everything in the case, which is maybe where you're going, but I'm just gonna, I agreed with the cite I cited.
I'm just going to read what you quoted then. So it says, a plaintiff must show the bank knew facts that led the bank to suspect the person ordering transactions, breached his fiduciary duties, or acted without authorization, but the bank deliberately refrained from investigating to determine whether the person using the account acted in violation or without authorization, right? So you've got, you have, you quoted the part in there about authorization. So, and I have to say, I don't think for purposes of this question I'm going to be able to accept the idea that just anybody can call up, claim to be an authorized person on the account, and get a disbursement of funds. So you have, the bank has a signature card, and I presume it has a signature card for a reason, so they can determine who's authorized to make a withdrawal, right? And that's part of this authorization thing that O'Malley talked about. So why would we not allow a jury to look at this and say, you know what? They had a signature card, and all they had to do was compare the person's name to the signature card to see if they're authorized. And the failure to do that was an intentional sticking of the head in the sand, so you don't have to find out whether the person's authorized. Why can't we let a jury look at that?
You stopped halfway. For the purpose of not of intentionally deciding not to learn facts.
Right. Because, you would learn, if you would check the signature card, you would learn the fact that this person was not authorized to make the withdrawal.
I would tell you this. What you just asked would be my first question if I represented costs in a negligence case. Because what you're saying to the bank is you blew it. You missed it.
No,
you didn't recognize the signature card.
Right. So, okay. Let me just put a little finer point on that then. I think there's a difference between, gee, I forgot to check the signature card, and I just don't care to look. Those are different things, aren't they?
Yes, but here, somebody on the signature card requested the money.
In three-quarters of the transactions for cashier's checks, that's not true.
No, that is true. It's a question of directly or indirectly. There's no prohibition of somebody indirectly doing something versus directly. The signature card doesn't say she's got to do it personally, and she can't have an assistant do it.
I'm looking at this from the bank's perspective, right? So when I look at this from cost perspective, I say, of course, Ms. Santiago was the primary mover in this, and she was the primary malefactor and all that. But that's not what we're looking at right now. What we're looking at right now is whether the bank acted in bad faith. And what we have to determine is looking at what the bank knew and what the bank's actions were with respect to that knowledge, whether that constituted bad faith, regardless of whether Ms. Sackdavid was in the background pulling the puppet strings. So what I want to know is, why is it that the bank can come here and say, we don't actually require the person on the signature card to authorize this. Somebody can call up and say, I was authorized to do this by the person on the signature card. And you go, it's good enough. I don't really care.
Well, here you have proof in the pudding. You do it once. Nobody complains. Nobody says a word. You do it a second time. Nobody says a word. You give them statements. Okay. You give them debit.
Hang on. So I want to make sure you want to go down that direction, because there are cases that suggest that we look at each individual bank employee's knowledge. We don't accumulate it.
Correct.
Right? But what you're suggesting there is that we do accumulate it, but only in your favor. Which one is it going to be?
No, what I'm saying is nobody told that one bank teller, who might have done five or seven of these. Mm-hmm. No one told that bank teller after the bank teller knows they get monthly statements after monthly statement after monthly statement. No one tells the teller at the window anything.
Right. So we can assume, I think, probably safely, that no bank teller knows about any communications that the account holder has with the bank, right? An individual line teller is not going to know those communications. The individual bank teller is going to know what's standing right in front of her. And what she has standing right in front of her, someone requesting a disbursement from Costa's bank accounts that does not appear on the signature card. And the only thing that she's got is, well, she said that Ms. Davis said to do this, and you're telling me that that's good enough for the bank.
No, I'm telling you that those questions go to the heart of a negligence claim.
And it also goes to the heart of bad faith, because if it is the policy and practice of the bank to not find out, I don't want to know if this person's authorized. I just don't want to know. I've got a signature card. I can compare the person's name to the person on the signature card. If the person's not on there, I can call the company and ask, I've got somebody asking for money from your account. Is this person authorized, right? But the bank decided, I don't want to know. That's different from negligence, isn't it?
No, the bank didn't decide, I don't want to know. No one, there is no evidence. This case, as I said, was around for 6 years. Cost did not take one deposition of the 49 tellers. There's not one piece of evidence in this case that those tellers had any suspicion of anything or said, I don't want to know. In fact, it's totally bare, this transcript. That's a fact that's not in the record, that they said, I don't want to know.
Well, Counselor, I don't think we need a deposition for that, because people were withdrawing money from Koss's accounts without the tellers checking the signature cards. That's a part of the record.
But does a teller check a signature card every time there's a withdrawal?
This is happening over the telephone, first of all.
Right.
Sue Seitz-Steve is making the telephone call, or Julie Mulvaney is making the telephone call. Okay. These people recognize voices. They do it. They then put it in an envelope, give it to the messenger. It goes back monthly statement after monthly statement. No one says boo. If you're the teller, you're thinking, obviously there's nothing wrong with this. But even if it's negligent, even if the bank should have been a little smarter, should have figured it out at some point in time, recognized the red flags. As counsel for Park Bank said in response to Justice Ziegler, one of her questions, Park Bank was aware of those facts and turned a blind eye.
Okay. Your red light is on, counsel, so I do have to
ask you to let
the next attorney proceed. So, Attorney Olson.
May it please the court. My name is Joseph Olson, and I represent the third-party defendant and respondent, Grant Thornton. I will be brief, and I'm a bit of an interruption. I would like to address issues that don't go to the core issue in this case. With regard to the main issue in this case, what is the proper legal standard for a bad faith claim under the UFA, my client is in general alignment with Park Bank. I stand here today to tell you that my client generally agrees with the party that sued it at this point in the proceedings. What is important to my client and what issues still remain in this case that are kind of hanging on the edges, admittedly, are the fact that Park Bank did assert third-party claims against Grant Thornton, one for contribution and one for legal subrogation. With regard to the contribution claim, it was dismissed by the Circuit Court on July 20th, 2015. And while the Circuit Court dismissed it and dismissed it because it found that a UFA claim under the bad faith prong is an intentional tort, it applied the standard rule that there is no contribution for anything other than a negligence claim. On appeal, Park Bank did file a cross appeal. The Court of Appeals chose not to reach that issue. We believe that issue should remain dead. It should not be resurrected. The UFA is an intentional tort, even under the bad faith claim, and as this court has been very clear over the years, going back to at least 1959 in the Farmers Mutual Auto Insurance case, and again in 1996 in the General Accident case, the first prerequisite for a contribution claim is that there be joint negligent wrongdoers, not joint reckless, not joint strictly liable, not joint intentional, joint negligent. No one here today is advocating that the UFA is a negligence claim. And to hold that the UFA is a negligence claim would essentially repeal the UFA, which the entire purpose of it was to raise the duties owed by a bank. With regard to the legal subrogation claim, it is also legally deficient. That claim was dismissed as a part of the summary judgment motion and order that is before this court. It should remain dismissed because legal subrogation is applied when a volunteer pays an injured party and they have no liability. Park Bank's legal subrogation claim was predicated and is expressly pled in its third-party complaint that they only claim a right of subrogation if they're found negligent. So as Park Bank sees it, the factual predicate for Grant Thornton's potential liability is its liability, but that factual predicate would undermine a legal requirement of a legal subrogation claim that the person who paid is a volunteer and has no primary liability.
Counsel, is there perhaps an easier way of looking at this? If there is a subrogation claim by the bank against Grant Thornton, wouldn't that necessarily require that Koss could have sued Grant Thornton directly based on what Park Bank did.
Yeah, I believe that's correct, Your Honor. They would have to assert, Park Bank would essentially have to assert, not that Grant Thornton had its own conduct that was somehow also bad, but that Grant Thornton should bear the liability for Park Bank's own conduct. Mm-hmm. And that's not what they allege in their complaint, and they can't because we have no relationship with Park Bank. We're actually COS's auditors. So it is our position that while we're a bit of an interruption into the main issues in this case, that as this court decides what the proper legal standard is for a UFA claim under the bad faith prong, unless this court does something dramatic and rewrites it to the extent that it becomes a negligence claim, the contribution claim against Grant Thornton should remain dismissed. And we also believe that the legal subrogation claim should remain dismissed because it's legally deficient for the reasons I've explained and for the reasons articulated by Justice Kelly. That's all I have. I promised you I would be brief. I might be the first lawyer to have kept that promise before you, and I wouldn't be here to see me talking this little. If there are no questions, I'll sit back down.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Few points.
I have one I want to ask you before you begin. I did not, as Justice Ziegler did, review the first complaint COS filed with the current complaint. The first complaint, I know, was simply negligence, no UFA. The last complaint is simply UFA. Is it true that the allegations are the same in regard to the bank in both claims?
Your Honor, I don't know if they're identical. I would say they are probably very similar, but I would submit that that's irrelevant, Your Honor. And the reason that it's irrelevant is it's very simple. In most jurisdictions, including Wisconsin, you can plead alternative theories. And so the idea that if you have a negligence claim that is based on the same set of facts as a claim for bad faith, and that therefore the bad faith claim must be negligence, that doesn't make any sense because you could use that same logic in reverse.
I understand. You could have put both claims into one document. I'm not arguing about that. I was just curious as to your take, and you don't recall.
And they're not word for word, but right. They're very similar.
They are very similar, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, in you advocate the Master Chemical Corporation standard for bad faith, correct?
Excuse me, could you repeat that, Your Honor?
Yep. You advocate, you agree with the Master Chemical Corporation standard for bad, for bad faith, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Can you tell me what the difference is between the Master Chemical formulation and the Court of Appeals formulation in this case?
The principal difference, Your Honor, is that the test set forth by Master Chemical and other cases provides for what I'll call an objective standard, a standard that looks at what information was available to the bank, and would that information, if it had been ignored by the bank, would that amount to a deliberate desire to evade knowledge? Whereas the standard that's being argued for by Park Bank is a standard that is a subjective standard. Park Bank contends that COS was required to prove that there was actual knowledge and actual suspicion.
Right. And I'm trying to find that part in the Court of Appeals decision. So they have the two prongs. The first one, circumstances that are suspicious enough to place a bank on notice of improper conduct by the fiduciary. That sounds objective to me, doesn't it?
Well, not necessarily. In one sense, Your Honor, you're right. It could be construed as objective because you are looking at what a reasonable person would deem to be suspicious enough. But as we've argued in the brief, that standard is problematic in our view, separate and apart from the fact that it's not a consensus legal standard from other jurisdictions, but it's problematic because then it invites the circuit courts to speculate on what does suspicious enough mean.
But then in the Master Chemical formulation, it's cogent and obvious. Doesn't that require speculation as well?
I think that would be a fair point, Your Honor, yes. But at the same time, if this court, uniformity is a very important aspect of this appeal. And if this court were to adopt the Court of Appeals test, with the first formulation of the facts have to be suspicious enough, and the second, a deliberate failure to investigate, Wisconsin would become an outlier. And that would be problematic for a number of reasons. The first reason is that the Wisconsin legislature has mandated that the law be consistent with that of other jurisdictions. The second problem is that there would be improper guidance for the circuit courts and perhaps the Court of Appeal, because if the test is different, then you can't now rely on the case law from other jurisdictions.
Is bad faith a state of mind claim?
Bad faith is not a state of mind claim. And let me back up, and here's how I will answer that question, Your Honor, because there's been a lot of questions about intent and intentional conduct here. As we all know from first-year torts in law school, intentional tort can take many different forms. There's not all intentional torts are created equal. So you have some intentional torts that require a specific intent. In other words, someone at Park Bank was sitting at their desk, and they decided, yeah, I know Sachdeva is embezzling, and I'm going to help her. Okay, that's specific intent. The second form of intent that you have intentional torts is substantial certainty.
Is what? And
substantial certainty. Does the defendant, and I see that my time
you
is up here.
You can finish answering the question.
Does the defendant have substantial certainty that if they put blinders on, does the defendant have substantial certainty that a certain outcome will occur if the defendant acts in a certain way? And I would submit, Your Honor, that the bad faith standard is more akin to the substantial certainty standard, in that there were facts that were that were laid bare to the bank, and the bank chose to put blinders on and ignore them. Thank you, Your
Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for excellent argument. This is a tremendously interesting case. This is the kind of law that you can so really, really has so many parameters, and you did a great job. Your briefs were very good, and the arguments were very good. And this is our first shot at the UFA, and I think it's critically important, and you did a very good job in helping us to come to a resolution that will be helpful to those that will use it in the future. So thank you so much. We are now going to adjourn, and we'll reconvene for our third case at 1:30.